So, Zachary Mueller, your technical lead for Accelerate at Hugging Face, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you here. Thank you for making the time to talk with us. And you've been at Hugging Face for almost 4 years, right? Which precedes the whole Gen AI boom that unrolled everything we're seeing right now. Still, Hugging Face was already about 5 years old, which is crazy to think about because I would guess that most people who use Hugging Face, even daily, heavily, learned about it in the last few years, right? So before we jump into your job and even into what technical lead for Accelerate means, could you talk a little bit about those early days that you joined the company, what it was like?
Sure. It was, you know, it was true startup, not like in the insane startup world where we are right now, where everyone's everywhere doing some Gen AI thing. It was, you know, there was a very specific set of list of companies that I was considering working at. Hugging Face was like, oh, I'll go work there after I go to my first place because I was still in college. And then after that, I'll go work at Hugging Face because it's got, you know, everyone that I look up to. It had like Sylvain Guger, it had Stas Beckerman, you had, you know, Tom. Now, all these gigantic names that if you look at it now are off doing their own immaculate things. Like Stas is now over at Snowflake. Sylvain is now doing stuff over at Jane Street. And so it's really sort of a micro bubble when you look at what happened even 2 years after that and, you know, everything that's come out since. So it was, I had a lot more fun and time on the ground to like sit there and learn and, you know, really learn like what distributed training was like before, you know, Accelerate magically became the back end of everything. And then it was more dev experience than, you know, learning the algorithms. But yeah, it was a different world we had back then.
Did you feel like a research job more than anything else? Or it was like an actual programmer job in your vision back then?
It was a mix of both. Because like you had the research aspect where, you know, I had to go learn some particular microcosm that happens with distributed training. And then the second I learned that, I'm then faced with the software challenge of, okay, now you work on Accelerate. There is no magic allowed in that library at all. How do I write an interface that lets me do this very magical thing that I want, but without it being magical? And so the software engineering was always there because like, how do I write an API for this that, you know, my bosses will like, that we all deem is like magical enough to where it gets the idea across. But if someone went and looked at the code, they could relatively follow easily like how it worked.
And there's this thing that taking a step even further back in your career, which is insanely interesting, that you worked in marine biology. Is that it? Although I know that data is data everywhere. That's, you know, a pretty big change of scenery. How did that go from one thing to the other?
Sure. So fun fact, I wanted to do marine biology since seventh grade.
Oh, wow.
And I dedicated myself to becoming a marine biologist. I was a rescue diver by my second year in college, for instance. But when you're an analytical person, certain courses tend to be a bit more problematic. And so after a little while, sort of decided, okay, well, I'm not a visual person. I'm a very analytical person. That leads to math, that leads to programming. My dad made me do Scratch as a kid. So it was like, well, okay, let's do programming, see how it goes. And so that led me to the software design and development trek over at the University of West Florida, which changed my life.
Well, mates, I'm going to send this to my sister because she actually graduated in marine biology, but now she's changing and she's becoming a vet. So,
oh.
I mean, she's still with animals in the end, but maybe programming yeah, in the future, maybe Hugging Face.
Honestly, at the way things are going, I would not be surprised.
Yeah.
You know, AI is like in going everywhere now.
Yeah. But like when you joined Hugging Face as a machine learning engineer, that was like some years ago, that kind of like at least the last 2 years, they overlap with the period that saw the huge growth, like the explosion of Gen AI, all the models and open source models as well, like specifically as a whole. So on a personal level, what has it been like to help build this, which is basically the most important platform in the world right now in this field? Like, was there like a milestone when you realized, wow, now we are mainstream?
Yes, actually, there is a very specific milestone. For the first few years that Accelerate was a framework, it lived separately in its own little world, where we were building this framework and like it was seeing a little bit of use and people were enjoying it. And then I forgot who brought it up. Sylvan, Julian, someone was like, okay, now we have Accelerate and we have all this custom code in the trainer. Can we just rip that out and shove Accelerate in? Enter, I think it was like 2 to 3 months of hard work between the team, and then Accelerate was part of the trainer. Now everyone knew what Accelerate was because it powered the main training framework they used. So watching just the pip installs go exponential was like, oh, there's now memes happening on Twitter because of Accelerate. Oh no.
That's when you know you made it.
Oh yeah. Like when, you know, people are sitting there going memes of like, okay, I'm going to do distributed training. Accelerator.prepare. I'm done. Ah, we've really made it now. This is scary.
Amazing. And since our audience is very broad, like from people who are AI researchers to people who work with, I don't know, product marketing, and maybe do not know what we're talking about, what Accelerate is, could you explain in a high level?
Sure. So when you do PyTorch training on multiple GPUs or multiple computers in some capacity, usually you have to use a number of different algorithms to help facilitate that training, and usually involves a chunk of custom code for you to get it done. Accelerate wraps that in a very low level style. So you keep like your basic PyTorch training loop, and we just change one or two lines to facilitate like getting the right class for you to wrap around to use like the DeepSpeed framework or FSDP without needing to like lose complete control over all your code. So it's a low level optimization to allow you to scale to 1,000 GPUs if you
want. Now the same thing to my mom.
Sure. Oh, God. Basically, imagine you're trying to train a model that like can't, like a gigantic ChatGPT, right? It's a huge model that they train on thousands of GPUs. I can't do that on my single 4090. So one option is to remove control and shove it to an API or some chunk of code that's like, I will have your data, please, and you will give me some weird hyperparameters, and I will make it work. Whereas Accelerate basically lets you keep control. You don't have to adhere to anything, and you can just keep going like you would be.
Right, and every Friday here, we have our news-only episode, when we try to fit the most important news of the week in the space of an hour, and we end up with a two-hour raw episode that we just try to compress it down to like 1 hour 20. We always think, no, we're going to make it into an hour. No, we never. We've not been able for a while now. And Fabrizio usually brings many studies. He brings up many studies for about different paths that the Frontier Labs are going down. And one very technical term that we've actually never covered in depth is distributed training for AI, right? And since this is your wheelhouse, instead of us trying to butcher a simplified explanation of what that is and then asking you what it is, could you just maybe go from there?
Sure. So basically, the idea of distributed training is you have this problem of, I want to train a model that fits bigger than what one GPU allows. And the different paths you take is, are the layers too big? So like, is an individual layer too big for me to fit on a single GPU? Or can the layers fit, but the model is too big? Depending on where you go with that, you either implement something called tensor parallelism, which takes a layer and splits it across multiple GPUs at once. Or if it does, you either use what's called the zero redundancy optimizer, zero, or if you're familiar with PyTorch, FSDP, or you do pipeline parallelism, basically, which basically sort of looks like a ramp up and a ramp down where the input travels to each GPU. And using these three sort of techniques, you can train pretty much any model you want as long as you have the hardware to do it.
And when you talk about training a huge model such as those, is it cheaper to do it in this way, or is it more expensive, but is what you have because you cannot use such a big GPU?
Sure. I mean, these generally will be expensive, right? But your biggest cost usually isn't monetary, it's time, right? People are shipping things left and right. Quen just released a new version, like, 3 or 4 weeks after the new Quen model, or however long it's been, 3 months, and it beat all the benchmarks. So your cost is time. And that's what distributed training does for you. A technique called distributed data parallelism basically says, on every GPU, I'm having a copy of the model. Its point is to get through data faster. So even if you have a tiny model you're training on, distributed training still matters because it is at a speedup rate of, you know, 1 to n. So like if you have two models on two GPUs with distributed data parallelism, it's roughly a 2x speedup because you can get through the data faster. So it's more expensive, certainly, because, you know, I can run one GPU for a very, very long time and it'll get the job done, maybe. But by getting it done faster, you could save some money in the long term, but most importantly, you're saving on time.
Okay, you get a competitive advantage, basically.
Yes, exactly. Or, you know, if something catastrophic happened, you can redo the training of that model without needing to, like, one-shot everything and hope it works.
Yeah. And when you talk about, like, these new huge data centers that xAI and Meta have been building, like, I think the xAI one have over 200,000 GPUs or something like that, the one in Memphis. It's crazy. Would they need that? Like, I want you to say yes, but like, is that what accelerator is for, basically, right? Like, to
yes.
To split across all of those. And do they need something on top of that as well?
Yeah. Typically now what people are doing is a wild idea called 2D and 3D parallelism, which is basically like, take each of those individual techniques I just said and wrap them in a trench coat with a top hat. And that's what this is. And what that means is, like, computers 1 through 47 are doing some topology of this. Then computers 48 through 90 are doing a different topology. And all of these help speed up training in different ways. So, like, there's 2,000 computers, we'll say, which is, what, 16,000 GPUs. All 16,000 GPUs won't look the exact same with how the model is split up in most cases. Because what you'll generally find is, like, you're always limited by speed. Everything is time-based, right? I keep saying that. Well, 100 gigabit Ethernet only has a cap out of 25 gigabytes of data transfer a second. If you consider a model in billion of parameters, 1 billion parameters is 1 gigabyte of data. So if you're training these gigantic models, you want to limit that bandwidth as much as you can, which is why these sort of weird techniques to train gigantic models with different, essentially, amalgamations of these techniques matter even in gigantic data centers.
What you're describing sounds to me pretty expensive when you think about maybe a startup trying to get off the ground now. Do you think we're going down a path that it's going to get harder and harder to make something that is relevant when it comes to horsepower when compared to a company that already has the structure in place to train and already knows how to train models with that? Because it sounds a bit unattainable to get in the field of what you're describing right now without having quite a lot of money to spend on machinery. Is that a problem?
No, I actually will disagree on that thought. Mostly because the way things have been going is, you know, we wait for the closed AI labs or the open AI labs specifically, especially like Alibaba and whatnot, to release their model, and then you perform post-training on it, right? And that post-training, even for a big model, still requires a lot of GPUs, but not at the extent or scale that, you know, you needed for the pre-training run. If you're a small startup and you're trying to pre-train, you must have pockets of gold. And, you know, these are complicated techniques, sure, but the Nanotron team at Hugging Face found that, like, even on an 8-GPU system of, like, A100s or H100s, it was still the fastest way to train compared to, like, what novel engineers would do. So really, it's understanding what the new techniques are today that are being used, and then also understanding that, like, you're going to come up with the same ideology on one computer that you would have, you know, if, say, Zuckerberg came up to you and said, like, hey, here is 1,000 computers for you to create the next Llama. Don't mess it up. Good luck. You know, you would apply the same thing there that you would even on the small scale. So, you know, I think people can, because also there was, I saw it today, a post where someone, where Casper Hansen did post-training on Quen 3 1.7 billion. Well, it actually wasn't Quen. It was, Menlo, who used Will's Verifiers library to essentially post-train their own deep research model on a 1.7 billion parameter model, and it works really good. So you don't need, like, the long story short is you don't need giant compute clusters to, like, get things off the ground. Arguably, the best science and the best outcomes come from small teams that are constrained on resources because they come up with the clever solutions to get state-of-the-art models.
Speaking about that, like working at Hugging Face, you must see these cases all the time. Like, what is the one that surprised you the most?
Where like small models, easily everything that comes out of the small LLM team. Like the fact that they do it openly and, you know, we were able to play with the intermediate checkpoints and everything.
That is amazing, I must say. Yes, I love it.
Yeah, like part of the challenge is like getting the data set for it because you got to deal with, well, if you want it to be Apache, you got to hurdle through a lot of hoops for data on that. And then also just knowing, you know, the compute that they're having to use for it and the size of the model they're training. It's like, well, okay, these things are tiny and they're training on, you know, 200 some odd H100s at once. I'm scared to think about the people that are training, like, I don't know, 480 billion parameter MOE models.
Yeah.
So that's definitely been the one where it's sort of a nice surprise every time it's like, hey, small LM's making a release. But even then, you know, Quen coming out every once in a while with these small models that just completely destroys everyone's train of thought of bigger is always better has been a welcome, you know, push.
I'll bet. And I'm pretty sure that there are many people who use Hugging Face who have never really gotten into what you develop in-house and see Hugging Face as this sort of, I don't know, LLM GitHub repository, which there are a lot of options. And we, on our Friday's episode, try to talk about what you are releasing in-house. And you just spoke to that. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the decision or the investment or the structure that Hugging Face is putting into place to keep doing that as the site grows in popularity with all the other stuff, the third-party, I'll call, models that are put in there. What is it to work with this structure to kind of plan where to go when the answer seems to be both?
Yeah, one thing that I think has a lot of alpha with Hugging Face is it's very small teams, right? Even like, I think technically, if you think about the numbers, the Transformers team is the most people, but also the Transformers team have cross-ownership, right? If you think about Accelerate, when we got started and even now, it's a team of four people. And that's all it's been. When I joined, well, it was two. It was myself and Sylvain. And so the core aspect is giving everyone the freedom to go work on the projects that they're dedicated to working on. And when you do that and you don't have wasteful meetings, you don't have wasteful stand-ups, magically a lot of stuff gets done. You know, people are very passionate about that because they're given the freedom to go do their work. And that's been the key success, right? Because every model that comes out pretty much has a Hugging Face like integration baked in. There's a whole team dedicated to that on top of the fact that if it's big enough, you know, it's a whole company lockdown of make sure this works, you know, go test this real quick. Everyone gets involved how they can. And that I think is the key success. Like, sure, on one hand, like they're making the release. On the other hand, we have to make sure that us as a platform is prepared to make sure that users have a gold standard release for that.
And going back to Accelerate, I'd like to ask about the support for other types of GPUs, like TPUs specifically. Let's say a friend of mine would like to write some code and run in both GPU and TPU, basically the same code. Like what is the current state of support for that?
So, all right. At this time, Accelerate supports CPU, GPU, NPU, MLU, SDAA, MUSA, and XPU.
Well,
so the answer is everywhere. You know, as long as you write the core PyTorch code in PyTorch and you don't do anything that's device specific, Accelerate is designed to just then go send off your code to where it needs to. You know, like, because there's every framework is a little bit different in how it wants to do a few specific things. But as long as you don't worry about that and you just make the PyTorch code go on one GPU, then Accelerate makes sure that it can happen across all, what, 9 of those different backends?
At the same time, even.
Same time's a little different. Because that gets a bit more involved, and I don't think anyone's successfully done that yet. Usually, you keep it in the same topology.
And still in the technical parts, in practice, when does flipping to FP8 really gives real wins, and when does it just blow up training?
So you need to be processing a certain threshold of data in order for FP8 to really be a win. I believe that number is around like 2 million tokens per batch, because in most of my experiments I've found, at least like running things locally on my 4090s and whatnot, I don't hit a scale to win FP8 is a win. It's been a black box for a while. That's why I know we'll talk about this later, but in my course, I'm having some experts on FP8 specifically give a talk about this, because FP8 has been a source of frustration in me, because everyone says it wins, and every time I try it, it doesn't. And the answer is usually the model's not big enough, or you're not processing enough data at a time. Because otherwise, like, it will slow things down, because you need enough processes to where the additional overhead, the like FP8 kernel costs, is surmounted by the amount of data being processed or the size of the layer.
There's this, we have a few struggles here in the podcast. One of them was the Friday episode, the behemoth that it's becoming. And the other one is to try to bring timely conversations about what's happening in the world of, I'll call it the world of AI. And sometimes we ask our guests, like, what do you see on the horizon that it's pretty impressive and exciting, but it's still a bit far away? And it has happened that we have had to ask this question. We got the answer. And between the time the episode sat there while it was recorded and then edited and then published, the horizon, we were past that. And that exciting thing was already sort of old news. And there was even better stuff, right, in the market. That said, what have been the most exciting breakthroughs that you've seen recently in distributed training and that excites you about what the possibilities that are still to come?
Sure. As I've been writing this course, I've had to learn a lot about this, right? And like, what actually is the latest stuff? And I'm always fascinated by what Prime Intellect is up to with the essentially di-loco training, essentially distributed training on a global scale. This was an idea that people first thought possible, what, a year or two ago when MLX first came out, and there were frameworks that could be like, yeah, you know, run a model on your iPhone and your Mac being connected at the same time. It's like, well, okay, why can't I do that with my neighbor's Mac? And now here we are, where we have some of the first models that have come out that are trained on consumer hardware across the entire world. Where I see that going further is, I believe at this time, it's limited in you need a certain GPU of a certain amount of memory because of just how things work. Where I want to see things get to is, oh, well, you know, my dad's got a 2080, a 3060, and a 1060 just because of where the time has been. And being able to strap all those different topologies together as one gigantic training pool, similar to what MLX is starting to do. And then that way we have truly decentralized training in the aspect of anyone can come with any hardware and we will find a way to have that help our training. That is what I'd love to see. Because then, you know, old gamers are going to sit there and like, well, okay, I'll slap on a cheap CPU, some cheap RAM, and just dedicate these old graphics cards to whatever training the next model is.
That's basically a peer-to-peer training. This is like are we talking about AI Torrent here or SETI?
More or less. Yeah.
Like the Citra extraterrestrial life, that you had like the screensaver on your computer that was using your compute. If you downloaded that, that was like in the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, I think.
Yep. However, in this case, we actually want it to do that, rather than it being a virus, if my memory serves right. Yeah, exactly. Like, and there's been a lot of work towards getting there, especially with like what the Prime Intellect folks are doing, Will Cobb and the folks behind Di-Loco, I believe, or something like that, where, you know, we're active research is being done by the Google folks to figure out how this can work. So that it's definitely an area where I'm very quickly getting very excited about what's coming out for it.
Awesome. And when you think about limitations that there are for distributed training that you are not sure that can be overcome with time, like in the long, let's say in the medium run, like the next 5 to 10 or maybe even 20 years, you said like for this specific case, this will not improve.
Laura is great, but I feel like finding cheap ways to lower memory will not work in the long term. I truly believe that while our models are getting bigger, if they continue to get bigger, they will continue to be unreachable for consumer hardware. Like even the Kimi K2 model, the cheapest way that you can run that locally is to go buy a $10,000 Mac computer that has 512 gigs of unified memory. Like the bigger these things become, the more unaffordable it becomes to run them locally. So what I would love to be wrong about is that we start seeing is that we no longer will be seeing models that are super small packing well above their weight. You know, that is essentially how you reverse it. You take these gigantic models and either through quantization aware training or just coming up with better ways that we can run these things at home without needing to be consumer locked. Because that's, you know, the dangerous path forward of open source models stop becoming better than closed source models. And there is a moat. And the best case scenario is there continues to be no moat.
And you don't believe in the Moore's law?
We're seeing conflicting evidence. Let's go with that.
And I think it's interesting that I've been following Apple's efforts in the AI world, their studies. They have that, I think it was a year ago, the LLM in a flash, that they have the actual model on flash drive, and they just switch and get little parts of it loaded into the RAM memory and then use that and then keep switching back and forth. And their local model, the new one, which is divided into two blocks, and one of them has zeroed values, which don't make that much of a difference in the inference, and the time per token, the time to first token gets faster. And we just had a conversation with someone from Google, and we were talking about diffusion, the Gemini diffusion model, right? And how that, to me, seems like this alternative to the ultra-aggressive models and the limitations and when it comes to speed, especially, and how that in the future will evolve into lighter models. And we already see that, right? How state-of-the-art models make what was state-of-the-art seem like child's play. And 2-3 months later, it's completely different. So it's interesting to see that, given what you just said. I keep thinking about, yeah, but, you know, 10 years from now, we're going to look at this conversation and laugh, right? Because we're going to think that you thought that this was really impressive, really? So it's interesting to see that happening in real time and faster, right? Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's definitely becoming overwhelming at a point where, like, I'm in this dichotomy of I want to put away, you know, X and everything in order to, like, detox. But also, like, if you went away this week, the amount of information you missed
exactly
is astronomical. And that hasn't stopped for the last, I feel like, 6 to 8 months.
At least 2 years, which is the time that we have this podcast. So.
Fair. Yeah, so like it is a struggle of like understanding, you know, first, what are the actual important releases? And then also, what are the smaller releases that doesn't get the big publicity, but will matter in, you know, 4 to 6 months down the road, because, hey, they were able to do that with this much less compute, but no one talked about it because it was a weird paper. And then, you know, come to find out, oh, no, this changes the field radically, which is, you know, what we're starting to see happen even in the pre-training world.
And watching from the outside, it's kind of fun.
No, I have a very specific case with this, because like a couple of weeks ago, I had to download an OCR model, and someone said, hey, there's this new one from Nanonets OCR-S, which is now one of like top 10 downloaded, most downloaded on Hugging Face for some reason. I was like, no one, like in my bubble, no one has heard about it. My bubble is like a lot of AI researchers and people on Twitter and whatever. Like no one had ever mentioned that. And I was like, oh my God, this is actually really great. And now it's in the top 10 on Hugging Face. So it's exactly what you said. Like from 1 week to the other one, these models are released. They don't get any publicity, or at least the traditional one. But then people kind of start finding out about them and promoting them somehow.
Yeah, but even then it's, you know, a bubble of like, when I talk to my friends that use AI at work, right? I'm like, hey, by the way, you know that like Kimi K2 lets us have like Claude at home. And they're like, what's Kimi?
Yeah.
We're in a weird bubble. That's right. Twitter is not the world and everyone that does, you know, AI.
Yeah. And Kimi K2 in Portuguese, it sounds like the word for chemistry. Chemistry 2. So it gets very confusing. When we're talking about it on the podcast, we go like, Kimi, wait a little bit, K2. Otherwise, it just sounds like chemistry 2 and people might get lost.
I'm so sorry, listeners.
And actually, speaking of that, what are the models that you've seen recently? Because being on the inside, you also get surprised if you just said, but what are the models that people may not be aware that exist that have been doing very well when it comes to, you know, fill the blank, something that has impressed you and is off the radar?
Off the radar, I'm still watching the Quen post tunes. It's been very problematic from what I've heard, but I've been keeping an eye on them. Kimi K2 is, I think, genuinely my main one. The thing I personally believe that people don't realize is they limit themselves to ChatGPT or Cursor, and there's many other tools you can use. Like, just a peek behind the curtains in my own world, I'm actively using 6 different models at once. I'm running my own version of Whisper running on a Raspberry Pi that does audio transcriptions that I built myself. I'm also using, you know, Cursor. I'm using Kimi to help with my writing. And then I've also got one website that I use for deep research that combines Gemini and ChatGPT at once.
Oh, what is it? I need that.
I believe it's Deep Researcher or something like that. I'll send a link. And then the other one that I use is called ChatHub, where I have anywhere from 4 to 6 different LLMs getting the exact same prompt at once that allows me to then take that knowledge and like summarize it down in my head to just get a vibe check of like, you know, in the last example I was doing, I was running like GPT 4.1, Claude 4 Sonnet, Gemini 2.5, Quen 72 billion, DeepSeek and Llama all at once. And like in decent throughput time. So really, I think it's less of a models that get people like less knowing about. It's more so the interfaces. And that's not even to mention Claude Code. Like, good Lord, I started using that thing 2 weeks ago and I wondered what I've been doing with my life.
And when you talk about these huge models coming from China, like Kimi and DeepSeek and Quen and all of those, like, do you have a contact, like, do you support their team in any way, or they just publish on the platform?
No, we work pretty heavily with the Quen team and the Kimi team, and really indiscriminately everyone that releases models on the platform. We try and make sure that we're involved in some capacity to make it as smooth as possible, because you know it's important to us to have day one support of as many things as possible. That's why, like, day one support of GGUF models tends to be a thing of quantized models, because the more that we work together, the better the community is overall, right? The better the releases are, the better the publicity is, and most of all, you know, the ability to just immediately get it into people's hands as fast as possible. That's why also, like, the MLX community is very, very prominent in this area, because the day something releases, they do the quantized aware training and get it quantized sometimes in the same day. You know, like I'll just go out and it's like, oh, a model's been released. Yeah, the QAT will be available in 7 hours. Like, that's impressive speed.
And going back again to the beginning of your career, we talked about the marine biologist aspect of it all. But as far as we know, that you, one very cool thing about your career is that it started after you took a machine learning course on FastAI. Is that it?
Yes. So I could arguably thank my entire machine learning career to taking Jeremy Howard's 2019 Practical Deep Learning for Coders and the Pairing Part 2, because the first got my feet wet into learning how to do things, because Jeremy teaches top down. So you're not sitting there trying to understand the math. You're sitting there lesson one classifying cats and dogs. And more than that, you're classifying by species with a ResNet model. And then, you know, by the end of the part two, you've built PyTorch from scratch and you're reading papers and implementing them as part of the course.
Amazing.
All within 12 lessons. So like these 12 lessons took me 2 years to go through because that is the level of granularity that you can get into these things. You know, like you pick a topic and you just follow the T structure. The proven method for learning something and becoming an expert in it, right? You get your breadth and then you get your depth as far as it can go. And then after you've reached a critical point where you're no longer interested in it or you want to learn something else, start a new one. And you keep doing this enough and the content there is dense enough that, yeah, 2 years can go by and you're like, oh, I've been doing this for 2 years now. What's the rest of the world been like?
How much did you know when you got on?
Nothing.
What was your starting? Like, people are listening to the podcast thinking, like, as you just said, like, how do I jump in if it's accelerating? And it's so overwhelming that I don't know the jumping point to accelerate as well. So when you took the course, how much did you already know as a baseline to start and actually go through the course?
So I could say something cliche like, well, the best day to start was yesterday. But on a general factual basis, I was, I believe, 2 months into, I think I was a semester into my degree program.
Right.
Because I was learning coding at the time. I had some prior experience with coding with Scratch and very light Java with Lego Mindstorms, but that didn't go anywhere. Just ask my dad. But it was very early on into my college endeavors where I was learning this. And so what I want to harp on that about is like, yes, I have a software engineering background and I have a software engineering degree. I coded no Python in college. You know, it was all Java, which made me want to rip my hair out, and then C++, which was slightly better. But in the meantime, between all of my classes, I was learning this stuff because it's not fundamental learning of like how a language works and all of that. It's practical knowledge of like each lesson. The way Jeremy did this beautifully is you're building a different model. You're training a different model on different data. So like lesson one, you did cats and dogs. Lesson three, you were doing like satellite imagery and getting like information about what was presented. And so, yeah, like if we go back to the cliche, the best time to start was yesterday and the best, you know, second best time is now. But genuinely, the tricky part is figuring out what to start with because, you know, the landscape's A, changed, but B, also hasn't changed a lot because the fundamentals still matter. And I genuinely don't think I could be half the engineer I was if I just limited myself to one platform's learning anymore, right? Like the Hugging Face courses are amazing pieces of content. You can still pair them with something else and further yourself compared to your competition, right? I had no formal training in AI and here I am. So I still believe that like, even though Jeremy's made new courses and whatnot, the 2019 Fast AI courses specifically is this golden era of learning where especially if you can dig into the part two, you won't feel the need to take any course again unless it's on a specific topic, unless it's for a specific reason. Because it is just one of those courses like the Stanford AI course, where if you take it, you understand everything going on. And even if you don't, you take it and you look at what's going on and you can trace the paths to get there.
Amazing. And I still want to stay on this topic. First, just something I'm curious about. What was your level when you joined Hugging Face?
That's a good question. Because I was still in college. I was in my third year of college in the program. I think it was year four by that point because I had switched majors. And I believe I came on as an MLE. I didn't come on as an intern. Memory serves me right. But by that point, I had had an internship and a job at Novetta where I was doing some light ML training and research. And I was also teaching my own courses on AI, the Fast AI framework, and whatnot. So in terms of work experience, somewhat limited. In terms of experience and doing everything I can to like learn what I can, quite a bit.
Cool. And now, like we say, like history doesn't repeat itself, but it echoes. You are the one offering a course, right? So tell us about it.
Sure, yeah. This, I believe, is, if I count my earlier test cohorts when I was first starting out, I think it's like my sixth course. In terms of published courses, this will be my third. And the idea behind it is distributed training's complicated, right? You said it yourself. And I want to make that as less complicated as possible. And you can either go two ways about that. You can either explain it easier or teach people the hard part in a fun way. I'm choosing to do the latter path. So essentially, the course is designed to go through the basic algorithms that everyone uses. So like we mentioned, FSDP and DeepSpeed, pipeline parallelism, tensor parallelism. We build that up from scratch. And then that way you can train a model and have sort of a capstone project of, hey, I use this technique that I implemented myself. I understand how this works and I can understand, you know, what's happening in the background besides these people that just pick up Deep Speed or pick up FSDP and hope it works. Now, on top of that, there are currently 18 speakers, I think, some ungodly number of experts that I've brought in to come talk about specific topics. So like we have people at Meta who are going to talk about what it's really like to train on 1,000 GPUs at once. So Von Guger is going to help with giving this introduction to FSDP and what's going on. There's a whole pre-training track to get people up to speed with like, what is FP8 training really? How do you train these models for different pre-training tasks? And it's sort of become a conference more than a course, which is both daunting because you start out making a fun little course that has five lessons and now you have almost 20 speakers. But also it's an invaluable moment to learn from everyone in the industry that's actively using these tools and building these tools in most cases to understand where they came from, why that matters, and most of all, how to get your hands on it and build real experience. Because typically, you know, people can read and try and do all they want. I want to make sure that they have both the access to the resources to train the models, as well as the knowledge to go and apply it to the compute that our generous sponsors are giving us to let these students walk away with something they probably couldn't do without it.
Amazing. And when you're planning the course and inviting the speakers who are like in the top companies in the markets, how did you plan it to make it coherent in a way? Because when you have like a lot of people with a lot of different teaching styles and things like that, you know?
It changed on the daily. Because basically, like, you know, there's a bunch of cool people I follow. And I'm like, well, okay, I'm writing a course. And I have, you know, the folks from Hugging Face that are going to do talks. I wanted to make sure of that one. So they got priority. And then as it was slowly coming together, I'm like, well, okay, as I'm doing research on this, there's this technique that sort of pairs well with it. Who do I know that teaches that? Oh, let me grab him. And then they'll reference me to someone else and someone else. And then slowly this becomes a bubble of like, okay, somehow I have 18 speakers that all magically fit into their own framework where everything flows. Even if I have to make a completely new track for them, I'll make it work. And so that's sort of how it became this all-encompassing conference that even then there's like 30 other topics that I wish I could cover and people I could bring in that I will in the next cohort. Because like, on one hand, I want to get everyone in here. On the other hand, I don't know if I can write annotated notes fast enough. And on the other hand, I don't know if people will be able to keep up with that much information. So it sort of became this snowball effect of, magically, if you ask people to talk about the stuff they love and the things they work on, they say yes more often than no, which is great, but then leads to a challenge of I have so many speakers now. Oh, my goodness.
And Zach, I don't know if you have the same expression in the US, but in Brazil, when there's like a big promotion, something like that, a big offer, we usually go to a supermarket, something like this, and they say like, the boss got crazy. Now everything is like 50% off, things like that. And now, guys, I would like to tell you that Zach was kind enough to give the listeners to Yasob Controle a special discount when buying his course, right? But Zach, but I'm going to let you talk about it.
Sure, yeah. Typically, you'll see advertised that I give about 35% off to help people come in. But after being invited on the podcast, I didn't want parity to be an issue with your listeners because, you know, this is a different market and worlds are different. And, you know, some places the dollar is better than the other. So we spent some effort and I believe it's like 45% off for you guys. If not a little more, it's about that much. To help you guys get in, understand this knowledge, and really help make this cohort your own. There's already like 150 people in this. And so I really want to get everyone I can into here on a global level, because the more that we can democratize this information, the stronger as a community we all become. And so I saw this as a great opportunity to try and help out some folks that, you know, the big price tag courses are a little out of reach most of the time because they don't care about this stuff.
Yeah, let me just say that this was completely proactive. Zach just said, you know what? I know that the Brazilian real isn't as strong as the dollar, so I'm just going to give a further discount. So thank you very much. That was very nice of you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Yeah, it was amazing. And if you guys are interested in purchasing his course, the link, of course, is going to be in the description already with the promo code attached to it. So don't go directly to the website. Click the link that we have here on Spotify or on iasubcontrole.tech.
Yeah, please don't go directly. You will be scared. Please don't be scared.
And after this little promo moment, Zach, I have one last question to you, which is like a just like a funny one I was trying to make, which is complete the sentence. In 3 years, training a 1 trillion parameter model will feel as routine as dot, dot, dot.
Ooh, fun challenge. Training a ResNet on ImageNet.
Oh, cool, cool.
That was a good one.
Excellent. Thought I was going to go general with that.
Yeah. You just made some folks Google some stuff.
Perfect.
Yeah. So, Zach, thank you very much for your time, for sharing your knowledge with us. If folks maybe want to continue this conversation directly with you or learn more about what you're doing at Hugging Face, everything about Accelerate, where do they go?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter or X. I think it's like at the Zach Mueller. I'm on LinkedIn. It's not private. Feel free to send me a friend request and whatnot. And then also I'm restarting my daily Substack, the Mueller Minute, where basically I try and explain a distributed concept to you in a minute or less read. It's free for everyone. I specifically don't want money for that. Like, it's just me jotting my notes down. People shouldn't pay money for that. Good Lord. But those are the three major areas. There's also YouTube somewhere. It's got a few of my courses on it. I think it's Zach Code or something like that. But those would be the major areas.
Awesome. I'll leave the links in the description. I'm just making this huge course. I'll just start a daily Substack. You've got guts.
It's fine. Look, it's fine. And, you know, by the time this comes out, people will find out that I'm writing a distributed taxonomy of like
Jesus.
18 pages of terms and definitions. You find one thing and then it leads to more and more and more and you just want to keep writing.
Yeah, that's the fun part.
I know the feeling, Zach. I just enrolled for a master's degree this October, so yeah.
Woohoo! Good luck.
Thanks.
All right, thanks. This was awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This is a lot of fun.
E bom, para você, depois que você terminar de fazer o curso do Zach, se você quiser continuar se aprofundando no mundo da inteligência artificial, você pode conhecer a Escola de Inteligência Artificial da Alura em alura.com.br para ver os inúmeros cursos, as inúmeras formações para você atuar em praticamente qualquer área junto de inteligência artificial, então desde a área do design, vai para programação, galera, mais de dados mesmo, tá tudo por lá. E você pode aproveitar, porque está rolando uma promoção bem bacana da Alura, com o maior desconto que você pode receber de até 30% se você fizer a escolha pelo novo plano de 2 anos de duração da Alura para ter acesso a todos os cursos, quantas vezes você quiser, os novos cursos também que vão pintar na Alura dentro desses 2 anos, é ilimitado quanto você conseguir comer. É seu. Então faz o seguinte, vai em alura.com.br para conhecer melhor não só a Escola de Inteligência Artificial da Alura, que é, no fim das contas, o foco aqui do podcast, mas também as outras escolas, incluindo programação, front-end, data science, DevOps, UX, design, mobile, inovação e gestão. E eu e o Fabrício estaremos de volta na sexta-feira com o nosso tradicional resumão das notícias do mundo da inteligência artificial. Até lá!
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura, mergulhe em tecnologia, e Faculdade FIAP, Let's Rock the Future, edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.